My name's Christy. I am adult child.
Hi, Christy.
I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about what it was like. I'm going to start with my mother because that's where most of the mental illness and addiction took place on her side of the family. Both my grandparents, her parents, were alcoholics. And she was born in Reno, Nevada. She had a brother who was 2 years older. When she was two, her dad went to work and never came home. And she got a letter from him when she was 35. He'd been living in San Francisco. He'd been homeless most of the time, an alcoholic. When he finally reached out to her, he was living in a mission, like a low-income kind of place. And we had an opportunity to have a relationship with him for a few years before he died of cancer. And that was really a lovely thing. Her mother ended up getting married 6 times in total. She died when she was 53 in a mental institution. My mother had been both sexually abused and physically abused by different teachers or stepfathers. And when my mom graduated from high school, she got in her car and just started driving. And her car broke down in San Francisco. She had all of her belongings in her car. And when she went to go get help to get her car fixed, somebody broke into her car and just took everything. Shortly thereafter, she met my dad. He was in law school there, and she wasn't interested in him at all, but he pursued her like crazy, and so she finally just said, okay, I'll marry you. And then he wanted to have children, and she said, okay, I'll have children. And I was firstborn, and she was 21, and my brother came 2 years later. She had started a business by then, and young, 20 years old, she had started her own business. And when she was pregnant with my brother, she knew that she had made a big mistake with my dad and that she was not happy, and she was out the door. So as soon as my brother was born, she left. My father was just very emotionally abusive to her and physically occasionally. So we started off, the three of us. The way the settlement worked, that, you know, my father saw us every other week and we didn't have money. My mother worked like crazy. She worked a lot of hours. She'd come home late at night. She was a model. She had a modeling school and an agency, and then eventually she had a fashion college. She offered 2-year degrees, and she was very successful. And so there was a lot of pressure. She was beautiful, but she had very low self-esteem. She got that. Her parents were, her mother was very abusive to her. And so I think she carried that down. You know, I kind of grew up thinking I wasn't enough. There was a lot of pressure to look perfect. You know, I'll give you a few examples. I was thinking about this today. So when I smile, my gums show. And she didn't like that. So I had a button, little exercise with a button and a piece of string. And I was supposed to pull that, you know, so I could lengthen my upper lip so that my gums wouldn't show when I smiled. So I was always very self-conscious of my smile. Now, also, we would put a book on the floor, and I would put my toes on the book, and I would stand on the toes, and if my calves didn't meet, then my calves were not right. So I had to do exercises to build my calves until I would do that exercise and my calves would touch. And I was also very flat-chested at some point I developed in high school, but there would be bust exercises. So there was just this constant pressure to look good. On the other side, with my father, I was very dyslexic growing up. And when I was a kid, we didn't really know what dyslexia was. But I would transpose numbers. I was a terrible speller. You know, capital I's were always written backwards. And I'd have special tutors and all kinds of things to help me get better. But nobody quite knew what was going on. I had a hard time reading. And my father would say to me, "You're not stupid. You know, I don't understand what is wrong with you, you know." So I had just always felt not enough. I wasn't pretty enough. I wasn't smart enough. My father was very critical. He still is. I have a real appreciation for kind of where I am now. You know, I'm learning in these programs. I'm a survivor. It's kind of a miracle that I survived my childhood. Let's see. My mother got married 2 more times. She was engaged to a nice guy who we liked. She ended up dropping him for his best friend, who we didn't like, and his best friend disdained us. She married him twice, divorced him twice. He had 2 children. My dad remarried, had a daughter. My stepmother was 10 years older than I, so she was 20. My dad was 38 when they married. I was 10. And so there was a lot of change. We moved all the time. When I was in maybe fifth grade. We moved probably every year to new schools, new house. As my mom made more money, my dad did not help financially much at all. As my mom made more money, we would move to the better neighborhood. We came home from like Disneyland, I think when I was in third grade, our house had burned. There was an electrical fire. It didn't burn to the ground, but everything was ruined, basically. So we had to move into a hotel, and I didn't have anything left. I mean, everything was gone. I remember I had a Snoopy stuffed animal. I loved stuffed animals when I was a kid. And I had this stuffed animal that was kind of gray, and it smelled like fire, and that was like the one thing I took with me to the hotel that we lived in for 6 months. Certain messages, and I'll get to the recovery in a minute, but, you know, my dad, he also, you know, he was a depression baby. Both my parents were depression babies. There was a lot of emphasis on being successful and making money. That was kind of how we got approval in our family, you know. But he would also say things like, my mother would send us to private schools, and he would say, you're not smart enough. What a waste of money. Why is she spending her money sending you to private schools? When it came time for me to go to college, he said, you know, you're just going to get married and have kids. Why are you even spending money going to college? And my brother and I had a pact when we were 7 or 8 that we would never have children. We literally said, we are going to stop the crazy family line with our generation. We are not going to continue to do this to the next generation. And neither one of us had kids, nor did my half-sister. And I, not for a second in my life did I feel like I wanted to have kids. I was really always clear about that. When my girlfriends were playing with their baby dolls and their carriages, I just wanted to play with Barbies. That's really, I just love Barbie dolls. You know, I wanted to be an adult. I wanted to go out there and tackle the world. Never was a good student in school. Was very mediocre. My brother was really, had straight A's. He was a big sports person. I could care less about school. I was very apathetic, I would say. Didn't have friends. I was very shy. And finally, in high school is when I think I started kind of blossoming. I started to come out of my shell. We kind of stayed in our one place for a while, started to make friends, and that's when my life started changing. But never talk about my mother's addiction. The story goes when my mom was maybe 20, she went on a roller coaster and hurt her neck, and like overnight had terrible, terrible headaches. So my father took her to his friend who was a doctor. He started prescribing prescription medication. And that addiction just kept escalating and escalating until I got to junior high school where she started shooting Demerol. And it was kind of like a Michael Jackson scenario. You know, she would go to one doctor and he finally would get what was going on and they'd cut her off. And then she'd find another doctor that would prescribe this medication. And it was a crazy thing. Here she had this pretty big business. You know, she'd come home late at night. We were pretty much had nannies and babysitters most of our lives. On the weekends, she would be in so much pain and doped up, she would go into her room often, especially as we got older and the disease progressed, and just shut herself into the room for the weekend. I mean, we wouldn't even see her for the whole weekend. My brother just checked out. My brother and I were never close. We bickered and fought all the time. I think our parents kind of enjoyed that, you know, the drama thing. I thought that was kind of cute or something, which is kind of tragic. But we've never had a real relationship. And yeah, it's sad. I was thinking as I was listening to Kevin, thank you, Kevin, that I have a brother, a half-sister, my stepmother, my father, my mom. I'll talk about my mom again in a second. But I have a relationship with my dad, but I don't have any other real relationships with my nuclear family, nor do I really want to, because they're also riddled with mental illness and addictions, and I don't really want to be around that, to be honest with you. So the way I define family now is more, you know, you guys, the people who have kind of walked in my shoes and are doing this hard work to get better, you know, to achieve the things that we're trying to achieve. And I don't, for me to get to that place, I kind of have to limit where I came from and interacting with the people that I came from, because it just triggers me. It brings it all back to me. Someday, maybe I'll be elevated enough that I can handle that better, but for today, that's where I am. My mom was always suicidal. She tried to commit suicide before she met my dad. She and a girlfriend closed the doors of their house, turned on the gas, woke up the next day, didn't work. But she talked about it a lot when I was a kid, and I know that really affected me too. And that was my fear of abandonment. When I came into this program and I heard the thing about, you know, where we have a fear of abandonment, we're afraid of authority figures, we isolate, I thought, oh no, none of that applies to me. And then as I started reading the literature and hearing all of you, I'm like, oh yeah, it sure does. I know that that was my core thing, that my mother was going to die. Either she was in the hospital a lot, she was near death several times, she talked about suicide, threatened it. And I knew that that was, like, I thought in my mind, if she dies, I cannot live. If she dies, I'm going to kill myself. That's what I would think as a kid. You know, eventually she did. I was 32. I hadn't talked to her for 4 years, neither had my brother. And I knew she would eventually. So I got a call from the police, and she, sure enough, she had overdosed intentionally and left a note. And the first line of that note said, I have no children. And it was kind of an FU suicide note. And it's funny, you don't know how you're going to feel until it hits you. You know, you kind of think you know, given any situation, how you're going to react. And then it comes, and the reaction is not at all what you expect it to be. It hit me like a ton of bricks, you know? It still hits me like a ton of bricks. And the big question was like, I could not have a relationship with her. It was like she was dragging me down. You know, it was like she was going down and she was going to take me with her. I really felt that way after being so codependent and trying to help and fix her, whatever I thought I was doing. And then the question was like, and I just kept saying it over and over, does she know how much I love her? Did she know how much I loved her? You know? And the neat thing about that question is I know now that she does know how much I love her because I tell her all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm moving. I'm moving tomorrow. I'm packing. And I came across a bunch of birthday cards and Christmas cards that I write her now. I still write her every day, Mother's Day card every year to express my feelings to her. And I know just as I am in touch with my higher power and I have these feelings of intuition a lot, now that I'm more conscious and I'm more quiet, that is my higher power. But I also know sometimes I could feel my mom there warning me or guiding me or doing whatever that feeling is. You know, this beautiful thing. I don't have any regrets over the way it worked out. It just is the way it was. I can't, you know, I hit myself on the head for years and years and years about having wished I'd done it differently. And I'm at peace with all of that now. I really am. You know, I understand that, God, she had it hard. She did the best she could. I think all the time, I say this to my brother, I could not have juggled all those plates. I could not have done what she did. I would not have had the energy. I don't know how she moved us all the time and kept getting married and divorced and working and hiring people and having problems with work and tax, all that stuff. You know, I can barely hold it together with no kids, you know, my dog and work. And I want to talk about my spiritual awakening a little bit. I was married for a long time. I met a neat guy when I was 20. He was total normal. You know, I always say I could have gone the high road or the low road. You know, I was dating a lot of wild, crazy guys in college. I was a big, loved to drink, you know, loved to party. And then I met this guy who was really normal from Texas, and he was Republican. His family, his father was a colonel in the Air Force. He was a really normal guy. They ate dinner at the dinner table. I never even considered what that concept would be like. You're not watching Brady Bunch and Partridge Family. And we had an 8-year courtship, and again, I never thought I'd get married, but we got married, and we were married for 20 years. And I didn't realize I found out he was having an affair, which totally shocked me. I really thought we'd be together forever. And of all the people I knew, he'd be the last person I would think that would have had an affair. But it was like one of these things that God did for me what I couldn't have done for myself. I would have hung in that marriage for the rest of my life. I didn't realize how unhappy and unfulfilled I was in that marriage because I had no sense of who I was, what my needs were, you know, my emotion. This is before program. I didn't have any program then. And I see now it was like that codependent thing. He never really took care of me financially, but emotionally he really did. And I didn't even know that until all of a sudden he was gone. And it was kind of like that feeling probably after my mom died. It was like, man, God, this is like really for the first time in my life. I'm kind of like, this is me and my two dogs, you know. It scared the hell out of me, and I didn't see that coming. I thought, oh, I'm tough. I'm tough. I'm independent. I don't need you. Screw you. I'm going on. I'm going to sail into the sunset. And then all of a sudden, it was like, I'm scared to death, right? So I'm sure I was depressed at that time. I lived in L.A., grew up in L.A., and had my own business. 2008, things were starting to change. And I had this opportunity to move up here. My family owns a business up here. And my dad's 88. Nobody was stepping up to be the succession plan. And I thought, you know what? I'm kind of ready for a change. So I moved up here 6 years ago. 10 years ago, one of my best friends who knew my mother worked at her school, went to her school. I've known him for 30 years. Gay, black, younger than me. He kept saying, Christy, I want you to go to Al-Anon. I said, no, I'm fine. Christy, I want him, no. Christy, for my birthday, I'm coming down from San Francisco to Los Angeles, and I want you to go to an Al-Anon meeting with me for my present. And I think of that all the time when people say, you know, say it once. Thank God he kept on it. He loved me that much that he didn't give up on me. And that first meeting I went to, before the meeting even started, I knew it was the right place. After a few years in Al-Anon, I heard someone talk about BDA, which is Business Debtors Anonymous. And they said, I got more out of BDA than I ever got out of Al-Anon. I never heard of BDA. I'm like, what is BDA? Business Debtors Anonymous. What is that? And I didn't know what it was, but I knew I needed it. Because I wasn't in debt, but I had a really screwed up relationship with money. I went into sales, you know, I'm geared to like make money. That's how you're going to be, you know, loved in this family. So I went into sales. I've been in sales my entire life because I knew if I was in sales, I'd have, you know, straight commission most of my life, that I can make a lot of money. And I was a workaholic. My ex-husband was a workaholic. My parents were workaholics. It was really convenient when you're married to a workaholic and you never see each other. And I know that workaholic is kind of one of the isms that we hear about in our literature. And I didn't realize what I was doing. I was just checking out of my marriage. And I'm sure he was too. But where was it? DA. So if I had it, I spent it. I think I had it, but I didn't feel like I deserved it. I wasn't good enough to have this money. It was messing me up in my head, right? So I was a compulsive spender. I became a collector. I was thinking this. One way I disassociated as a kid was reading. I was either sleeping or reading. I loved to sleep. When I was a kid, you'd be in school, like, what's your favorite activity? Be sleep. I just want to sleep. I want to, like, check out of my life, not be around my family, not be in the bickering and all the crap. I just wanted to not be around or read. And I remember my first Nancy Drew book. Any girls like here like Nancy Drew? I became like, I had to have every Nancy Drew book. And then I started collecting little cat ceramic things. And I've been a collector my entire life. And that's where it's been some kind of an outlet for me to have, like, maybe because I had all the stuffed animals when I was a kid, to have, be surrounded by the stuff I loved gave me comfort. Thanks gave me comfort. And I had to look at my relationship with thanks, you know. So my spiritual awakening when I moved up here, I thought, you know, the seed was planted in LA. I'm like, I wonder if I could just live like this really simple life, like a hermit, like a little monk. You know, and give all my material trappings, leave them behind and see what happens. And that's kind of what I did. I moved up here. I found a little tiny place. It's like 400 square feet, a tiny little hotel refrigerator. I'm moving out tomorrow. I've been there 6 years. And I haven't had a TV since I moved here. I rarely listen to the radio unless it's, you know, podcast or something positive that's feeding my brain. I realized that the disassociation thing I learned about in here, that watching TV or the things I did to zone out, going to a flea market or whatever, eBay for hours, I can be on eBay for hours, that was a way for me to disassociate. And I think as I just turned 60 this year, I have so many books. I'm one of those that someday I'm going to read that book, someday I'm going to read that book. I do not have enough time in my life to read all the books that I've purchased over the years, right? And so what am I doing to keep me from doing the thing that I really don't love. I'm watching TV, and I don't even care about this when I'm watching. So I made that conscious decision, and it was one of the best things I ever did because it's so quiet. The quiet used to make me really nervous. It had to be like constant chatter, you know, like you get up and then you turn like the radio on in the morning and getting ready, and it was just like all day long, constant something back. And now it's just, I just like the quiet. It's been so good for me to get to this serene place. It was almost like withdrawal for a while, you know, just to get to that calm, floaty. And now I'm kind of in this zone, you know, I try to keep this zone of serenity. And it's been stressful moving, and work has been really stressful lately. And, you know, I've been going to meeting every day in one program or another. After DA came to UA under Earners Anonymous, that kind of filled a plug. I went to some SLA meetings, the sex and love addiction meetings. I was on the total anorexic side of that program because I was just apathetic. I didn't really care if I was ever in another relationship again. You know, I knew that wasn't very healthy. So I thought, okay, let's look at that for a little while. It's fear. It's just all fear that I'm going to get tromped on or hurt or whatever the fear is, you know. And by doing all the step work, the thing I realized was in each program, it all roots down to fear for me. It's all fear, you know. And so what's the alternative to that? So the alternative is God, you know, it's being in faith with my higher power. And that my higher power has always had my back. You know, every single thing that happened, instead of the tragic, oh my God, we had a fire. Oh my God, my mom killed her, committed suicide. You know, there is a silver lining in everything. And the silver lining is that my life has never been better. You know, I can genuinely, honestly say that. I met a fantastic man, my partner Greg, in program. In a million years, I would not have thought I'd meet somebody in program. But it was neat. We knew each other for a couple of years in Al-Anon. And, you know, so you get to know people. You hear their shares. We had so many similarities. Talk after the meeting. It's like, God, I went through that too, you know. And I think it is kind of a neat thing to be in program with a partner because you do have the same language. And it's been a real blessing. And I think once I kind of dusted off my divorce and thought, okay, God, I knew right away. I've always been kind of a positive thinker. I think my mom raised us that way, which was a huge gift. Okay, God, I thought he was my soulmate, but this must mean that he really wasn't or wasn't forever. But I know my real soulmate is out there. And all my friends in LA, my program friends, they always said to me, you were so sure that you were going to meet somebody. And I said, yeah, I was positive. I knew that. And I know that you are too. They don't know it, but I know that they will because they're amazing women. You know, and I was in no hurry. And I just took a lot of time because I felt I wasn't quite ready yet. I wasn't quite enough healthy, I will use the word healthy enough, to attract the man, the healthy man I wanted. And as I was packing, I found a list. Somebody had given me the exercise of writing down the 10 must-haves of the man you want in your life and the 10 hope-to-haves. There was a list of 20. And I found it, and I went through it with Greg today. I'm going to embarrass you. But I said, you're all 20 on my list. I was like, this is God, you know? And I think having goals, I hear that too. Go Greg. I've been hearing, I think goals are really important as well. I'm going to talk about goals for a second, you know? I found out 3 weeks ago on a Monday, I told my landlords, I'm never leaving here. It was heaven where I lived. I just loved it. And I knew that wasn't very realistic because their daughter also wanted to live there. And, you know, how can you trump a daughter? So they called me on a Monday. They said, you have until like October 6th. And I said, okay. By Friday, I found a place. The second place I looked at. And I kind of knew what I needed. I have a dog. You know, the first time when I moved up here, I had a hard time finding someplace. The second place I saw, I just walked in. I thought, this is it. I just knew it. And I credit that to program, too, of not being wishy-washy, not doubting, not thinking the better thing's going to be around the corner. It's like, God, thank you. I gave you my list. This is exactly the list. Thank you so much. You know, and then I negotiated some things with my landlord, which I think was probably the money program. You know, I'm not going to be a doormat. I'm going to stand up for what I want. I'm willing to walk away if they say no. But I'm going to express my needs and expect that my needs will be, they're reasonable. I expect that they are going to be met. And thank you, God, they were met. It's just such a beautiful thing to see it and just be conscious of the process, you know, and not take it for granted. I'm 1 minute. Thank you. Yeah, that's the thing, right? It's just being in the gratitude part of it. You know, I have them. And that's the nice thing about being quiet, too. And slow. I used to be really fast. I was like a spinning top because my isms, my disease, kept telling me that if I went faster, it would get better. And I would be more productive and I would whatever. But that was just the fear speaking, right? And now I just, my middle name was Molasses, seriously. I just am like, if I feel myself the gearing, doing the thing, and I've been doing that, I feel like, okay, no. You do that contrary action. You know, if I feel like I have to respond to the text or the email or whatever, it's like, no, 24 hours. You have, you know, that 1 minute, 1 second of pause for every hour, for every year you're in program. So I'm just eternally grateful. Thank you all for letting me have this opportunity to speak to you. Thanks. Mm-hmm.